Well, we heard about different interesting proposals for a description of the universe in these talks. Well, and then we heard about gravity waves. Let me start from description of the universe. So the question that I think is general for all of you, you all described interesting progress towards a satisfactory description that aims at matching observations. Of course, you have to do some assumptions on your theory when you do this. So in your opinion, what is the weakest point, the weakest assumption that you had to make in order to get these results? Who wants to start?
Ladies first.
Difficult question.
Always. Right. Yeah, so spin forms is this non-perturbative approach. And so I guess in the first part where I derived already there was a continuum limit, but it did rely or it was a perturbative continuum limit. So it did assume that spin forms, if you see that really as a many particle systems, will lead to a smooth manifold. So that might be kind of, I do think that is likely to happen, but it has to be proven because we kind of start less fundamental than say causal sets or even causal dynamical triangulation. So we already have variables which are geometric and which we can use to consider coarse graining or renormalization flow. So that is already at least a big help to consider these questions, but in itself is also very, very hard question because it would mean, you know, putting like something at least 50 to the power of 4 building blocks together and simulating them. And right now we are, you know, non-perturbatively computing the Lorentzian path integral, and for that we would need new techniques. And I guess, well, for the second part, that is cosmology, and it was a mini superspace reduction, and there's always, it's actually a similar criticism. How do you know that the many degrees of freedom indeed will lead to this mini superspace reduction, and that this is a valid approach? So it seems to work out for cosmology, because, like, I don't know, mini superspace reduction is not too wrong. But again, you would have to, it's an open question, you know, to which extent are these mini superspace reductions valid, and would adding more and more degrees of freedom not destroy that? Now here I'm more positive because you can look at these question in stages. You can add at least in the discrete formalism, which is has an advantage. You can add like more and more degrees of freedom without going to infinity. So you can start with 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees of freedom and so on. And so that seems to be kind of a very doable program in the next few years.
Okay, next, who wants to go?
Well, there are several weak points, of course. The first one, on the first part of my talk, which is based totally on string theory. So you have to assume that the string theory is the fundamental theory of nature. And there has been a lot of progress for the last 35 years or so. So things are being understood better and better, but we still don't know what string theory is. So that's this is something that there's a lot of indirect arguments, but the theory itself is not yet well defined. So that's an assumption. And then after that, you say, well, what if assuming that, what is it that I can learn from at low energies? And that we use a combination of things, combination of a string theory input, you know, the existence of the brains and things which are very, very solid within our understanding of string theory. But we use also effective theory. So we are using the low energy described by effective field theories. That I find reasonable, but there may be a surprise that, for instance, all this infinite tower of states on string theory may play a role at low energies that we don't know. So that's something that we are just neglecting them. And there are issues like, for instance, the Hagedorn temperature that people have found within string theory. It hasn't entered into the description I told you about cosmology. It didn't enter into the whole description. So there may be something missing there, which is the critical part. And of course, we don't know what to say about the Big Bang singularity and so on. That's one part. The other part is getting the sitter. Getting the sitter, you have read the archives in the last few years. There's a lot of debates and discussions and people on one side and people on the other one. And I'm on the side that is okay. And I would say I'm with the majority in that sense. So in that sense, I'm conservative. But I recognize that as people say, a big claim needs a big evidence, and so we have to work harder and harder to make the evidence compelling. Of course, just saying string theory doesn't exist because I just have some conjecture, I would say that it's even weaker because it's a stronger claim. There's zero evidence. So in that sense, but we have to be clear that it is not a well-established thing. Then on my last part, that was not string theory, it was just vacuum transitions. I think that there's plenty to be understood there. It's a very rich system. People have spent all these 50 years trying to understand the black hole information paradox, which I think is very good. And the argument they give is that is because black hole is like a theoretical experiment where you can test quantum aspects of gravity. So this one is also of that type. So the vacuum transitions, you need both the quantum aspects of gravity, you need gravity and quantum. And the questions are very, very interesting and very important for our existence. It has been much less understood. And what we are doing is just a small step in trying to understand in an alternative approach that everybody else has followed. And I'm sure there's plenty to be understood there. And it's not clear that the rules of the game are very well formulated there. So I think there's plenty to be done there.
Okay, so my problem is that I've been sitting here thinking about what are the weak points. And the longer I think, the more there are. Okay. So I won't have time to explain all the weak points. Let me focus on a couple. Of course, our picture of the Big Bang singularity is extremely crude at this point, and so it will rely on calculations of the type Bianca has described in order to make sure that this picture is really valid. So it's extremely simplistic. The other point I want to draw attention to is these dimension zero fields, which we're using to get the large scale fluctuations and cancel the vacuum energy and so on. So in a way, it's an attempt to do what supersymmetry was doing. It's canceling the vacuum energy, but without new particles. So that's obviously extremely ambitious. And the problem with it is when you introduce dimension zero fields, then in principle, any term in the Lagrangian can be multiplied by an arbitrary function of these dimension zero fields, unless you have some sort of principle to restrict it. Now, Bob, in his talk, used shift symmetry to restrict the basic Lagrangian. But the essential statement is we do not yet understand the principles, we don't have a geometric interpretation of these fields, and therefore we're really taking very, very preliminary first steps. Hopefully, as with Fernando, we're actually looking for principles which will decide why there are 36 fields, why are they necessary. I can tell you my hopes, but so far, these are only hopes.
Yes. Well, this was more about
can I just comment?
So I had more questions for our fourth speaker.
Can I just comment that gravitational waves, Fernando made this point, are actually the key to the future of all of our fields. Mm-hmm. In particular, so I showed this picture of a microscope where we're looking back to the Big Bang. The gravitational waves created at the Planck time would have millimeter wavelengths today. If we get to see them, we can literally look at the Big Bang singularity and verify, was there inflation? Was there some sort of conformal singularity or not? So they are absolutely the future of the field. It's extremely challenging, but their amplitude is not that ridiculous. The amplitude of a Planck-created graviton today, the strain, would be a little bit less than 10 to the minus 30. You know, admittedly, that's many orders of magnitude from what we can currently see, but it doesn't look impossible. Mm-hmm. And given the amazing abilities of our experimental colleagues, one should not underestimate the chances of seeing them.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure if anyone has comments about what we just heard before I go to Lavinia. Yes, there was one that, well, okay, first up there and then down here.
I have a follow-up, a specific question on this to Neil, because I'm curious to understand what are the predictions. Are you saying that this conformal symmetry is really at the Planck scale, so you expect a universe of that typical size? I'm saying it puzzles me because if you take all the matter of the universe and you condense it in a Planckian region, in a region of a Planck length, you have a density, an energy density that is much, much higher than the Planckian energy density. So, yeah. So.
Sorry.
My question is, can you? I saw you nodding, so I think you confirm the idea is that you have a Planckian size universe with
no,
a conform.
No.
Okay. Then I misunderstood. And the second question, so if you can answer to both, is what are the predictions if you have a conformal era for the primordial gravitational waves?
So I think the answer is that if there is a conformal era, then the size is a meaningless notion. But if we interpret it from our point of view, it would be 10 microns across at the Planck time. If we just extrapolate our observed universe back to the Planck time, it's about 10 microns across, much bigger than the Planck length. But if at that point the laws of nature become, and the matter becomes conformally symmetric, then it doesn't know about the singularity at all. So that's the picture.
So in terms of predictions for primordial gravitational waves, what would you
say? They're very subtle. They're very subtle because gravity, as you know, is not a conformally symmetric theory. There's a Planck mass in Einstein's theory of gravity. And so, you know, one possibility is that gravity becomes effectively Weyl squared at the singularity and therefore is conformally symmetric, but nobody really knows. I mean, again, Bianca had some indications of the emergence of Weyl squared. Maybe that term dominates. Maybe the Einstein term is subdominant at the singularity. That's a possibility, but nobody really knows how this may work.
Thank you.
We had a question here from Abai.
Yeah, so I have some questions for two speakers. So first for Fernando, I mean, I really liked your very realistic assessment of where we are and so on. But I think what a lot of us who are not working in string theory would like to know is really, there was a prediction of supersymmetry, and in fact, people thought they should have been found 10 years ago. At first, it was reasonable confidence, and it's not been found. And as you said about cosmology constant, I mean, there are mechanisms, but these mechanisms are not foolproof. I mean, there are issues associated with it. And more than that, at a fundamental level, it is negative. and somehow to get, we have to do a lot of work to find a positive Kurzweil constant. And then there are these extra dimensions, and then as you come down, we don't have complete control on that, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, at what stage would one say that, well, I mean, this is the cumulative evidence is strong that this perhaps is not the most fruitful direction, especially with supersymmetry not being found. I mean, these are foundational stones, right, basically. If this was some, you know, one fruit there and you can just throw away that fruit, but these are really roots of the theory. So at what stage one would say that, well, I mean, perhaps this is not the right direction?
Yes, I guess it's to me. Yes. Well, that's the thing. There's a one thing is that, well, you can think whatever you everybody has their own opinions, but for me, the string theory at the level of consistency and mathematical structure is extremely convincing. Yeah. And you have been, you know, all the big successes, like well, ADS-CFT is probably one of the greatest ideas in the last 25 years. And that came out of a string theory. And then you were learning a lot from that. So it's a new way that none of us were thinking about it, that could be happening. Yeah. And it's still being developed, and that may be generalized to different kind of space-times or different co-dimensionality and this kind of thing. So there's plenty to be understood there that it was totally surprising, and it's very, very deep also. And it's helping now with this famous Page curve and so on. The counting of black hole states, the Waffa and Stromberg, it has been generalized recently to ADS spaces in a very beautiful piece of work. It's very formal mathematical, and things fit exactly as expected. for mathematics, the discovery of mirror symmetry is outstanding. Mirror symmetry is something, you know, you can see all these manifolds. For a mathematician, they look different manifolds, and then they needed the string theorists to tell them, you look, there's the symmetry. That for each of these manifolds, you have to find an equivalent manifold that changes H1 and H1 2. And now, actually, I met one of my colleagues in Cambridge who's a mathematician. He told me he's an applied physicist because he's a mathematician doing an application of mirror symmetry. So I think it's a new field in mathematics. And there are all these calculations that you have seen that people do and everything matches. So that gives you trust in the theory. Moreover, the understanding we have now compared to 25 years ago on the thing that I told you is impressive. You have making progress. I remember since the beginning of string theory, the big thing is that the string came up is because of chirality. Getting a chiral theory from extra dimensions was a big challenge. And then getting one chiral that is anomaly free was a big challenge. And string theory started satisfying all that. But then it gives you also the chance to get the whole standard model with all the structure that we have with the number of families and so on. So and then combined with this aspect, for me, model stabilization is key, and it was key since the beginning. And it was something that the first 15 years of string theory, model stabilization was totally something that was a mystery. And we were doing something that said, look for a standard model or look for something, assuming that something will stabilize the model. And that was a very strong assumption. Now there are concrete calculations, and including exactly everything that you have in string theory, for instance, fluxes, before it was being set to zero, there's no reason to set them to zero because they can be any integer. So setting it to zero is a solution of a measure zero in the whole space of solutions, and having brains or so, all the things you have to have them. The perturbative and non-perturbative effects is not that you want to put them or take them out. They have to be considered. And once you include them, they give you something more and more realistic. So that's a good reason to be optimistic, because the thing that you were not getting realistic is because you had not introduced all the ingredients. And once you start adding them up, then they give you something that goes in the direction that you want. So in that sense, I don't see any reason to be pessimistic. The point about supersymmetry, I have to say, is sad. From the string theory point of view, because independent of string theory, I would say the most enthusiastic people about supersymmetry were the experimentalists more than the theorists, I would say. And because they took us too seriously somehow. And that started in 1990. So I remember I was at CERN when the lab came out with the unification story. All the experimentalists suddenly changed from laughing about supersymmetry to being completely converted. Mm. And whereas the theorists, we always knew that there is just a beautiful setup. And of course, it doesn't say anything against string theory. String theory needs supersymmetry, but doesn't tell you which scale is broken. It needs to be broken, and doesn't need to be broken. I have to mention that, if I have a couple of seconds, there was an article for people who are outsiders. I live in the UK, so I like The Economist very much. I read it every week, and I always respect them because they have very they're very thoughtful and they're arguing in a very well way. I don't agree with them most of the time, but I respect the way that they write things and they're very educated. But then they wrote something that appeared in the first page of The Economist and said, well, now string theory is ruled out because they haven't found supersymmetry. And for a general audience, people would believe it because I usually believe what they write in the first page when they write about something else. So I wrote a letter to them, said, oh, you're making a mistake. This is not the point. And then they came out and said, oh, no, we're not telling you that you can work on pure mathematics. The string theory is very good, but it has nothing to do with the real world. So I said, who are you to teach me about that? I work in this field, and I know supersymmetry can be broken at any scale. And the string theory doesn't tell you what scale it is. Okay, so people were using it because of the hierarchy problem, and that had nothing to do with the string theories in the beginning.
I think I appreciate very much what you said, but I think arguments you gave, like mirror symmetry or this, the calculations for the page curve and so on. Page curve calculations has almost nothing to do with supersymmetry. It has nothing to do with the string theory. Actually, it's just a
very good thing. Very good.
So
yes,
there are many things which are inspired by string theory.
Absolutely.
As opposed to string theory per se. Mm-hmm. And so there is another article which I thought was much more balanced. And this is actually was written by a journalist who was a journalist in residence that you probably know it, right, at the Institute of Advanced Study. It has appeared in several places, including Quanta Magazine, but it's also on their website, mm-hmm, which says that string theory has not succeeded in its aim of unifying gravity with quantum mechanics, but it has a second rebirth as a very rich set of tools which can be used in a wide variety of fields.
Mm-hmm.
And it really resonates with me. And of course, I had interviews with many, many people, including the people, string theorists in the Institute of Advanced Study. But to me, this is completely credible. But I think that there's a difference between it being a very rich conceptual structure, a mathematical structure, and it being a theory of our physical universe. It may be, as you say, we don't. It may be. But on the other hand, the evidence is weakening. I mean, in the sense that hopes were higher, in that sense.
Yeah.
I think as a conceptual, as a chest of tools, it is just fantastic. I agree.
Absolutely.
But having to do with our real universe, the case has been weakening, I suspect. And I wonder if you agree with this.
So, yes, I think so. Well, I'm not a standard string theorist, I have to say. But I'm a string theory because of the potential contact with nature. I'm not too enthusiastic about this formal aspects and so on. So I'm always trying to see if there is something that you can eventually measure. And I have survived over the last 30 years. There's always plenty of questions to ask. And the string theory gives you the framework where you can ask the question, you can derive things, like like the potential for the inflaton. I can have a field which is the inflaton. I don't put it by hand. It's a field that comes there. I can compute the potential, and then I can see it gives me inflation or not. And sometimes it happens. So this is I find that very, very appealing. Or finding something with three generations of quarks and leptons is impressive. You look at the spectrum of a string theory in 10 dimensions with only graviton, an antisymmetric tensor, and a dilaton, and suddenly from that you get three generations of quantum quarks and leptons with a lot of realistic properties. And so that is, for me, is very, 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 very convincing. Most of my colleagues, I would say, are less enthusiastic about these phenomenological implications. But for me, that's what gives me the drive, and that's what I think. Yeah.
Just a comment. It seems that it is kind of easy to get the correct primordial evolution, right? It seems that in any model that people are studying, in the end, there is a way to get there, to get this inflationary phase. Or so, are there counterexamples to these that you know of? Well, this is again for all of you.
Counterexamples of getting inflation.
Counterexamples. So, in these days, we have seen several talks, including today, of models of quantum cosmology or quantum gravity aiming at describing our universe. They all succeed somehow. So it would seem that it is kind of easy to get that.
No,
so
it's very hard.
Is it just an... yeah, so...
We only talk about the ones that are somewhat of a success. Most cosmological models are terrible failures.
Well, of course we do hear only about the ones that work.
I guess it depends on how natural you find an inflaton. On how natural you find an inflaton.
Yes.
So,
I mean, just to emphasize, I never mentioned the inflaton. We don't need it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is easy.
So are there mechanisms...
The correct evolution without having to put...
So then there's Starobinsky, so that might be coming from some higher order corrections, I guess. I do remember, I think it was Lee and Fotini-Marcopolo. In principle, you could possibly go around some issues like the horizon problem by making your theory more non-local, or very non-local in some sense. Mm-hmm. I guess it would be a good criterion to have inflation without inflaton.
You don't need inflation.
or not need inflation.
Only measure we know on the space of cosmologies is the one derived from Alla Hawking. That's the only one we know. And that measure says that the typical universe is flat, homogeneous, and isotropic. So we don't need a mechanism. That's my conclusion.
Yeah, so I was wondering whether this argument explains why in many fundamental models of quantum gravity or quantum space, then it seems that one can find, for example, a de Sitter phase, which is a first approximation.
I'm not trying to describe the set of models. I'm trying to describe the universe. Yeah. So, no, these models... But it's true that in almost all models, it's very difficult to get inflation to work. You have to really twist up the extra dimensions and put in fluxes and so on. So, yes, in that sense, I think inflation is less plausible because it requires a lot of contrivance. I should say that the theories I've worked on, like ekpyrotic models where you have a bouncing universe, are equally contrived. You also have to adjust the potential in a different way and so on. And for this reason, I have tended to lose interest in models which are too contrived. The reason is we look at the universe and there are only 5 numbers to explain. I mean, it's amazingly simple. The description of the universe. There's no evidence for complexity. And so I take that very, very seriously, that maybe we have discovered all the particles there are, maybe we see everything there is, and the Big Bang is this extremely simple conformal singularity. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very, very optimistic point of view, but I think it's worth pursuing.
Yeah, so related to this, so the fact that we have in fact, we can describe large-scale structure of the universe with a few parameters. And also we heard from Lavinia that the waveform of gravitational waves is described with a few numbers of parameters. I think you mentioned 10 parameters or something. So it seems that we have few parameters to play with. And this is a good thing on the one hand, because it means that it's simple. On the other hand, probably there's a lot of degeneracy, meaning that it becomes difficult then to distinguish models. Say you have 2 models that are explaining these parameters. Then what do you do?
We need to raise the bar. I mean, Lavinia is describing a theory with 1 parameter, Newton's constant. right? It's not even a new parameter, it's a very old parameter. That's the bar we have to aim at. But I think Lavinia should comment. She hasn't said enough.
I mean, yes, of course, I think I like this idea of, you know, having something that is simple, but good enough that that it can describe many, many different observations that we have, like from early universe cosmology to very late time cosmology, including all these exciting new gravitational wave measurements that we have. So as I was showing, I have only one parameter coming from the gravity sector, but there were all this other bunch of parameters describing what kind of objects we are dealing with. And that's already becoming very cumbersome, right? Because the models have to make some approximations, and you mentioned the degeneracies. And I guess the only way of breaking the degeneracies is really trying to combine many, many different type of observations all together.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I also, but I find it always fascinating and disappointing how far kind of linear quantum field theory on curved spacetime goes, because that's basically all that is needed to
right.
to come up with this formula for the WCMB.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really fascinating. No, it's great because mm-hmm. it's simple ideas and it's only linear, even linearized field theory on this curved background. But it's disappointing in the sense, oh, we have to really go far, far in seeing any quantum gravity effect.
True.
Mm-hmm. And well, Abai spoke about possible effects with a red and a blue tilt. And yeah, but we apparently have to wait still to see possibly deeper, as Neil mentioned, with the gravitational wave microscope. To see something, but indeed this is so far we are only seeing even the kind of linearized things, and I don't think we see 3-point correlation yet. I'm not okay, which I think at some point I was asking this question 10 years ago, but still
evidence.
Not there. So it will be interesting. How far do we have to push to see a proper quantum gravity effect?
Yeah.
And then maybe it's for Fernando, because you had this big table with different models and with different parameters you can match. So it seems indeed that typically we have an easy time to you know, to fit our models to some predictions and possibly only some very fundamental questions, you know, possibly Lorentz symmetry breaking or Lorentz symmetry mm-hmm. deformation might be a bit more distinguishable. So, yeah.
Can I mention something? This is like the, not disagreement, but just a comment about, to give some weight about what simplicity means. We all want this Occam's razor idea that, you know, to have the simplest explanation. But besides these five numbers, we have this 20-something parameters of the standard model we have to explain. So the standard model is not simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very nice neither. it's the principles are nice, symmetry and so on, but the model itself, you know, it's not very simple. So somehow we have to clean the search of simplicity in which direction, assuming, but the whole picture is not that simple in that sense.
No, the whole picture not, but mm-hmm. there is this contrast between
so you have to ask the question
standard model something. Of particle physics that
exactly.
is, mm-hmm. has a lot of parameters in some sense, and then the universe that has, well, at the moment we measure few things about it on the large scale at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you come from the non-perturbative side, there's also basically mm-hmm. this big task of actually showing that your theory in some sense is stable and leads to smooth manifolds and the world we know it. And so that has already has ruled out lots of non-perturbative approaches which relied on Euclidean quantum gravity. But actually, for me now, it says, well, the entire idea of Euclidean quantum gravity might not be the correct one. And it's a very simple reason it's basically the conformal factor problem which prevents any reasonable results. Yeah, but still there is this big task, and so for if you come from the other side, indeed, you know, it goes a long way, but then it's a question, do we have a theory which really explains what is happening in the Planck scale? So I guess that maybe is should be the comparable question to make contact, as Renata said, between NP world and P world, so perturbative, perturbative theory and the non-perturbative theory.
I believe there are a couple of questions from the audience. Yes.
For Neil, do you have any constraint on the UV completion of gravity to keep your simple picture near t equals zero?
No.
Well, you have curvatures blowing up other than the Weyl tensor squared. Would they affect your equations?
Sorry, why is the curvature blowing up?
No, aren't there other curvature invariants that do blow up?
No.
No?
I mean, in no, I mean the conformal, as I indicated, the conformal four metric is regular. So that means there are no, if you in the right conformal frame, there's no.
Oh, there's no singularity.
There's a regular four geometry.
You mentioned a singularity though.
Say again.
There's a singularity.
The singularity is conformal. It's in the conformal factor, and the conformal factor vanishes. That's why GR breaks down. But the conformal factor itself is analytic across t equals zero. So yes, it breaks down. The Einstein frame metric is singular. Einstein frame Riemann curvature is singular, but the conformal four geometry is regular.
So the Kretschmann tensor squared is singular.
In which frame?
Well, it's an invariant.
No, it's not invariant in the conformal frame transformations. I'm saying the conformal four geometry is regular.
If the underlying theory has other invariants in it that are not conformal, then you'd get...
No, it rests on the... I mean, all we've done so far is treat the matter as being conformal and treat the gravity as being Einstein gravity, which is not conformal. Yeah. That's all we've done. So it's a very good question, you know, what's the complete description? You need to be, how does the conformal symmetry play out in gravity?
Yes.
And so people like Philip Mannheim, and I think Maldacena also wrote a paper about conformal gravity, speculated that maybe the fundamental theory is conformal for gravity.
So this,
but then you have the problem, how does the Planck scale arise? You know, so we haven't...
But this does sound like some kind of constraint on the UV completion, then.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
So
I would say all we can really say we described is classical gravity, described by GR, coupled to a conformal field theory, which is the matter. That's all.
I just had a follow-up comment.
Just a second. Was there any question from online participants?
If this is a comment, maybe we can do that first.
If yours is a comment, go ahead.
No, I think sort of you're being a very clever witness here, going on both sides, so to say. I mean, as you said, Einstein, your gravity is Einstein, and therefore there is a singularity. The fact that the metric as a tensor field is perfectly smooth does not imply that the curvature is smooth, as you also said in the middle. So the fact that metric as a tensor field is smooth is not enough to get curvature. To get curvature, metric has to be invertible, and it's not invertible, and therefore there is actually a curvature singularity there.
Certainly a singularity.
And so, in the gravitational sector,
there is a unique analytic extension. That's my statement.
Right. So now the statement is that it's even slightly better than that, because you can also consider, as Bianca was saying, that we can just look at quantum fields, linear quantum fields propagating, which you know, it suffices for all kinds of things. And then the statement is that, I mean, to me it was a big surprise, that linear quantum field propagation, they can be propagated across a singularity in a smooth manner. Now, this is, when it was first told, people didn't believe this at all. It can be propagated unambiguously across the singularity.
That's correct.
Not only for the conformal, not only for the radiation field matter, but even for other dust matter, mm-hmm. which is not conformally mm-hmm. invariant. And furthermore, you can calculate, this is when I disagreed with you, that there is the quantum field theory is in Kernel space time is an advanced subject, particularly coming from algebraic quantum field theory people, and they have a very clean methods of calculating things like the stress energy tensor, expected values of stress energy tensor, and even that for the matter fields remains completely finite. I mean, it's a distributional valued object always, and that as a distribution is completely well defined across the singularity. So singularity is harmless, but it's not true that that there is. I mean, if I looked at myself going near there, I'll be torn apart because I'm not conformally invariant. So I'll be torn apart. So it has physical effects. So.
Okay. Questions from online participants.
So I have a question for Lavinia. It's about the memory effect that you mentioned, that there's a contribution coming from the memory effect. So I was wondering whether or not this is measurable with ground-based detector, because of course, as you mentioned, if you have free-falling particles, then you have a permanent displacement. But ground-based, I don't know about LISA, but LIGO-Virgo detector are not free-falling. So is this a problem for measurement? And in case this is a problem, will this be a problem for your test? Because you had some contribution that cannot be measured, at least with current detector.
Yes, absolutely. This is something that hasn't been measured yet, right? So with LIGO-Virgo precision that we have right now, we can also not measure it, but with future three generation detectors and a combination of many different satellites and LISA and so on, so we have now an ongoing project where we are actually trying to forecast what is the detectability capacity of LISA for detecting memory. But I am optimistic in a sense that at some point we will be able to measure it. And of course, right now, since we are not able to measure it because it's very small effect, of course it will reflect itself also in the balance laws. But because it's a small effect, also there it will reflect itself as something small. Only if our waveform models are really that precise and our data is really that precise, the constraining power will come.
Just a quick follow-up. I was not just measuring the fact that it's a small effect, which, I mean, I know it is, but also whether or not it's within, like, even if the ground-based detector were very, very precise, I don't know if this will be measurable because these are not free-falling, so they are held in place. So this was my doubt. I don't know if this also enter. So in principle, this might be even a larger effect, but not measurable with the ground-based detector. So, but okay, you were talking about LISA, so I don't think this will apply to LISA.
So yeah, our project is about LISA, but I think there are also people working at the University of Zurich, where they are looking at next generation of Earth-based detectors, and they were even more optimistic than actually for LISA. I mean, you could say the same thing about our detectors on Earth, that they are not in free falling, and then how do we measure the gravitational waves that passes there? So there is not really a huge difference between measuring a gravitational wave signal, because it's all about how test moves, versus the memory signal, which leaves behind a permanent deformation. So in both cases, you have to measure changes in length and shapes. So in the memory case, it's really about its very smallness.
Okay, thank you.
Mary, you have a follow-up on this, or?
I have a follow-up on that, okay. About the memory effect. Hi, this is Mary Sakellariado. We have calculated about a year or 2 years ago with a student of mine the memory effect from cosmological origin, and unfortunately we have seen that it's not going to be detected neither with 3G nor with LISA. So that's a JCAP paper of a couple of years back.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question for Neil. So this constraint that you find relating the number of fermions and number of Gauge bosons is very similar to the way you get that, for instance, critical dimension is 26 in string theory, right? You impose some Weyl symmetry, you have some Gauss system, you have some matter sector, and that kind of like forces you to do it. But in string theory in two dimensions, there's actually another critical dimension, that of the superstring, which is 10, and that is because in two dimensions we know two different Gauss systems, and you can pick one or the other, or you could pick a linear combination. So I wanted to ask if there's anything like that in four dimensions. Is there any other field that could play the role of that dimension zero scalar, like a fermion or something else that would allow you to make it more general or change the results of it?
I don't know. It's a good question. Right. Sorry, I don't know. Thanks. I'd like to discuss more.
It's hard to understand. Yes, I have one question for all. There might be a big elephant in the room, which is the Hubble tension, or maybe it's not so big. What would that provide? What would be the consequences if this tension is confirmed?
So I can give an...
That would be amazing.
Oh, go ahead.
Yes.
Exciting new thing, right? I mean, it would be then after some new physics, and it would definitely mean something. So, of course, we like our simple models, but if it turns out to be that that there is this H0 tension, or maybe it turns out that the model is not just simply a cosmological constant, but maybe like the inflaton fields, something more complicated, something dynamical, then we would need to take into consideration next simple model beyond the lambda CDM.
So let me say two contradictory things. On the one hand, I think there are always tensions, and one has to decide when to take them seriously. I tend to listen to astronomers like Wendy Friedman, who is very cautious about inferring too much from this discrepancy and who believes it may steadily go away. Let me say something contradictory to that, which is that if you do have these dimension zero fields, they are very infrared. We don't yet understand how they influence long-range forces, but they're almost certainly confining, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that they play a role in altering the expansion rate of the universe. But we just don't understand them well enough to know. So my first instinct would be to say, don't get too excited. But if the discrepancy continues, it will be revolutionary because it'll mean the local, the current expansion rate is actually different than the one at redshift 1000. And it means Einstein's theory is wrong.
Well, then some complexity in our...
Sorry?
Then we would have some welcome complexity.
Say again?
We would have some welcome complexity in our universe.
I think most people are depressed by the absence of complexity. I'm the opposite. I tend to like simplicity. I think the simpler things get, the more likely we will find a compelling theory that explains all of it. I mean, remember that the fact that all that the universality of free fall of gravity was observed a very long time ago. It's a very elementary fact. Most people didn't realize that it was the clue to the right theory of gravity. And I think we may be seeing facts of similar fundamental consequence in observations of the universe now. And it may take us hundreds of years to interpret them correctly. But I would take that as very optimistic, that we see some essential simplicity in the universe, and eventually this guides us to a whole new picture.
I have a very basic question for Lavinia. You showed for these open systems that the energy flux is related to the Lagrangian, or like the integral over L dot. Naively, I would have expected the Hamiltonian there. So could you maybe explain why this intuitive or very naive idea is wrong?
I cannot explain that this is wrong because it's not wrong.
Okay.
Absolutely, you can write the right-hand side also in terms of Hamiltonian. There is a very neat neat equation that you can write down. It doesn't matter in which form you write it. You can express it in terms of the Hamiltonian or this this explicit form that I had. In both cases, you get exactly the same result.
Okay, thank you.
Like you can really show it on a piece of paper. How the right-hand side can be re-expressed in terms of the Hamiltonian.
Great, thank you.
Is there any more question? Yes.
What is the role of the conformal anomaly, Neil, in your construction? I mean, of course, if you want a zero dimension scalar, I can give you lots, by the way. I'll give you conformal supergravity, for example, which has everything you want. You also got Weyl squared, and it feeds the cat. But you have to decide what you're going to do about the conformal anomaly. That theory happens to have a conformal anomaly. So how does that play into your overall scheme?
So our attitude is to treat gravity as a background. So far, that's all we can really do. So when I calculated the conformal anomaly, I deliberately did not include the graviton. People
but you should.
Like,
that's where the
well,
most important
people
part.
People like Arkady Zeitlin encouraged us not to, because he has a basic argument that that the anomaly in a symmetry which doesn't exist, Einstein gravity is not conformally symmetric. Is ambiguous. And that's all we can do. If we included the graviton in our anomaly calculations, it messes everything up. It introduces all sorts of funny factors and so on. So I prefer to think of it as, let's make the matter at least sensible, so the matter doesn't have violent stress energy fluctuations. And that point of view, I think, is confirmed when you calculate the graviton corrections to the graviton propagator coming from standard model loops at lowest order in couplings to standard model. The graviton propagator violates Callan-Lehmann representation, but then you introduce these dimension zero scalars and they cancel that violation. So I take that as a positive signal that you should first sort of make the matter sensible and then consider coupling it to gravity.
But a couple of breaths later, you were also talking about Weyl squared actions.
So the organizers are signaling me that we are beyond schedule.
Oh.
I am very sorry to interrupt you.
Okay.
We have one more minute. If this can be
done. I didn't catch Kelly's last comment.
Well, it's just that you were also a couple of breaths later talking about Weyl squared actions. So there.
We haven't
some
done any calculations in Weyl squared. So yeah.
Okay. So I think we have to wrap up the section. I would like to thank all the speakers of the morning for the talks and the discussion. It was very interesting.